Hey everyone, this is Kike. I'm so excited to be back on the podcast to share this episode that I did very recently with the wonderful Paul J. Leslie. I'm actually sitting here in the beautiful small town of Aiken, South Carolina. This was the first time that my wife and I had been to this beautiful state, and it won't be the last. We really enjoyed it. We love the great people and the food and the cocktails and all the trees and the nature and just the beauty and the spirit of the town. It's so wonderful. I got a chance to spend some really good quality time with my new friend and mentor, Paul J. Leslie, and his wonderful and lovely wife, Shelley. We got to go out to dinner. We got to go to their wonderful house and have our very first high tea, which we really enjoyed and we want to do again. And yeah, it was just great connecting with them, learning from them, and just enjoying their Southern hospitality and just their kindness as people. I really enjoyed this episode that I got to do with Paul, where we discuss his wonderful book, The Art of Creating a Magical Session, which is probably my favorite book on the practice of modern psychotherapy. I definitely think you should check it out. It's wonderful. I don't want to give too much away in this little intro. Please check out the episode where we discuss so many different aspects of doing psychotherapy in this innovative, creative, and interactive way. If you have noticed that I haven't posted as many episodes as usual, that's because my wife and I are proud to announce that we are starting our new private practice where we work in Katy, Texas. It's going to be called the Neurodiversity Center of Katy, where we're going to be doing creative and innovative and interactive therapy with people on the autism spectrum and those who have been diagnosed with ADHD and OCD and other diagnoses that fall within that larger neurodiversity umbrella. Can't wait to tell you more about that. But that does mean that the podcast will be put on pause. It'll definitely slow down. Yes, it'll come back. I'm hoping to get back to it, but I just don't have the time or the energy to really crank out the episodes with everything else that I have going on. So I hope that you'll be patient and hopefully it'll restart in a few months. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope that you get a lot out of it. And as always, I want to encourage you to continue the conversation. So Paul, it's really great to be sitting here in your home office. I'm so grateful for your hospitality today. Got to sit down and have some high tea.
Yeah, your first high tea.
So my first high tea. And like you said, it's going to be my favorite first high tea.
Indeed.
I hope it's not the last high tea. It was so good.
Oh,
it was
good.
So delicious. Yeah, your wife was so lovely and hospitable. And we've just had such a good time getting to know you guys.
Well, thank you. And I'm honored that you found us interesting enough to seek out to connect. And,
absolutely. I knew in listening to some of the interviews you had done before and in reading some of your books that we would be kindred spirits, and I'm glad that that's been confirmed.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've really enjoyed getting to know you in person.
Yeah, and you've gotten to enjoy South Carolina a little bit.
It's a beautiful state. We definitely want to come back.
Yeah.
I think we want to check out some of the other cities next time, but Aiken's been wonderful.
Oh, good.
Yeah, the people have been so kind.
Yeah, awesome.
So I know the stated goal of this conversation is just to have a conversation about your incredible book, The Art of Creating a Magical Session. And I've got to say, man, every time I read one of your books, I'm like, oh God, I think this is my favorite one. But I think of all the ones I've read, and I need to go back and reread the one on Milton Erickson, okay, which I read years ago. I think that was the first thing I ever read from you.
Oh, wow.
But so far, at least this one here, The Art of Creating a Magical Session, Key Elements for Transformative Psychotherapy, is the one that really captured my imagination and really kind of resonated with not only how I do therapy, but how I want to continue to do therapy moving forward.
Right. Well, honestly, this is probably my favorite as well.
Okay.
Of all the books I've written up to this point. That one, if someone said, I want to understand Paul J. Leslie as a therapist, this would probably be the one, even though I'm happy with so many other things
Sure.
I've written. But yeah, I'm kind of like you. It always will hold a special place in my heart.
Okay. Is there anything that really comes up for you in kind of making that statement that this is the one that's your favorite, that kind of maybe really captures something really important about you and the work that you do with people? Maybe we could start there.
Yeah, I think so, because the reason would be, I think, because I really didn't spend any time on techniques. You
Right,
know, the
right.
whole thing is about creating the conditions, the environment for transformation to emerge, rather than, oh, when client does this, then you do that. And I think that the good thing about that is it let people know that no matter what theoretical orientation they're doing, they can still create a magical interaction with their clients. The bad thing is that unfortunately some people were literally hoping there was a special, skill, technique that, oh, if I read this and now and then I can, every session will be magical. And it's really an attitude. It's a way of thinking about transformative therapy that really is the heart of the book. And one thing I will say that I'm actually happy about the book in many ways, but one is that I've grounded everything. I have researched that, and as you probably saw, anytime I make an assertion, there's tons of
Yes.
citations and empirical data behind what I'm saying, because I think the term magical, people, some are very intrigued, some get put off,
I was originally put off, I think. Again, before getting to know you, and I had read the Milton Erickson book and really loved it,
Oh,
but then
thank
years
you.
later, I think I saw it pop up in a Amazon, algorithm suggested reading. And without really giving it a fair shot, I thought, oh, is this another silver bullet or magical formula kind of approach to therapy, which I'm kind of allergic to? So I'm so glad that it wasn't that. It was, I think, the exact opposite of that. So why go with the language of magical? Which I'm so glad you did, by the way, but I'm curious if you could kind of unpack that.
Well, for me, I used magical in the def one of the definitions I found. There's multiple ones, but it was basically something that's so out of the ordinary everyday experience.
Yeah.
So when our clients come in, their quote unquote everyday experience is not too pleasant. So if there can be something to move them out of the ordinary, into an ordinary experience with the therapist, which then could then filter down into other areas of their life to help them create therapeutic change, I felt that was more important. Because I remember that old, I forgot who said it, lots of people may have said it, said people often forget about what you said and they'll focus on how you made them
I think
feel.
that was Maya
It
Angelou.
might have been, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think she was often right about that, because if we're not doing something within the session to create a connection, a sense, Bruce Hood, who's I think he's a neuropsychologist, talks about something called a super sense, a
Oh, I like
feeling that
that.
something is a little more out of the ordinary, that moves us, that makes us almost otherworldly, but not to that extreme. That's when people have that moment of, oh, something's happening here. Something in our interaction changes. And I'll even say, anecdotally, that in many of these situations, when that happens, you can literally, as the therapist, almost feel that something changes in the room.
Oh yeah,
So.
totally. And that makes me think. I'll get let's say prospective new families or clients that will basically ask me a version of this question. Why do I need to go to therapy when there's so many great like manuals out there or self-help books? And I'm big on saying there's a lot of great stuff out there, but there's something about the therapeutic experience that you just can't capture in a book. I think that connects to what you were saying.
Yeah. And, you know, not everybody needs to go to therapy. Some people, agreed, they could read that manual and it helps them, and they can pick up a Tony Robbins book and it changes their lives.
Sure,
and,
sure.
Hey, high five, keep rocking and rolling. But the people who do need to go to therapy or seek it out, they don't, a lot of times information's good. So we tell them, oh, have you thought about this? Or did you notice that? And that can be helpful. But without the experience of some kind of physiological sense that something, you know, is different, something creative's happening, something curious is happening, a lot of times that information doesn't go anywhere. Because I'd be quite blunt with you. Often my clients already know how to solve the problem. It's just
some of them have more information than I do.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Because they've done all the research.
Exactly.
They've talked to 100 million people. So it's not so much about the information. It's how the information is conveyed. And when you... It's like, for example, there's this, do you remember the first movie, Wayne's World?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There's a funny scene where that Wayne, this character Wayne, those who haven't seen the movie, he stops at this gas station to get a direction somewhere. And this older man comes out from the gas station and starts talking about, oh, I remember that street you're looking for. There was a girl there I knew, and oh boy, so many years have passed. And then the Wayne character looks at the camera and says, can we get a better actor? That was terrible. And then all of a sudden, Charlton Heston walks out, delivers the same line, and then Wayne's in tears.
That is so beautiful.
Because Charlton Heston, he was an excellent actor, but he has this presence, this ability to convey that information in a way, and they're making fun of it, but to where it moves people.
Yeah.
So when you as a therapist, me as a therapist, anyone as a therapist, is giving information or cultivating the interaction, it's got to be more than just, okay, well, I see what you're doing there is you have a negative view of self. How can we look at making that a more positive view of self? And that's information you can find on the internet. How is it conveyed? Does that person feel loved, cared for, supported? Some people's eyebrows might have gone up just when I said the word loved, but yeah. I'm talking that is what we do. We are in the love category. I love all my clients. Some of them I can't stand. They annoy me, right? But that's like our families, you know.
Absolutely.
Our family, but we love them deeply. Do we love them as a human being? And if at that deep level of care as a human being, if people sense that and they have that connection, and then you open up more possibilities for the way they're thinking, the way they're feeling, the way they're acting, it sometimes feels very magical. It's almost like you've become a wizard to them, but they're the ones also doing their part. You can't be a wizard without someone to observe the wizard. You know, it has to be kind of this co-creative experience.
Absolutely. So one of the words that's coming up for me and having just kind of flipped through the book again this morning as I was just kind of prepping for our conversation was some of the things you wrote about charisma, and just the function that charisma plays for the therapist in the therapeutic session. I wonder if you could speak to that and kind of just do your thing on why you decided to kind of explore that concept as it relates to the therapist in that relationship.
Part of it is that most of the great therapists that I've had the tendency to pester and learn from, and even those that I've seen from afar, even on video of the old days, most of them, there was something about them that I will define as charisma. It may not be what some people think of as charisma. And let me just say, the charisma is such a trigger word for a lot of people.
It is.
Because a lot of people think charismatic, they instantly think of someone who's using and manipulating people.
A cult leader.
Yeah, exactly.
We've been talking about cults this weekend.
Exactly, yeah. So, and sure, certainly that can happen. But charisma, the way I'm kind of thinking of it, is enough to where the person feels like they can connect with that person, that they are happy to see that person, that whatever that person's saying, you're more drawn to that person.
Sure.
I mean, you go back and you look at the old days, even if we disagree with some of the things they said or did, but Albert Ellis, Fritz Perls, Carl Rogers, Carl Whitaker, Virginia Satir. I can name all the greats,
sure.
You know, and there's people now, certainly. But they had a certain level of presence, and that's probably a better way to say charisma.
Okay.
But it is still charisma. You wanted to talk to Virginia Satir. You felt loved and cared for, and you just wanted to. Fritz Perls is God, I could do a whole hour on bad stuff about Fritz Perls, but the good stuff was that when he was on his game, he was almost hypnotic to sit with, from what I watch and all, and how he could pull things out of people that no one else. Could Albert Ellis getting people to sing crazy songs about their problems and getting people to laugh at themselves and badgering. Here's a guy who made a whole career out of badgering people out of thinking irrational thoughts,
sure,
right?
Sure.
You don't have a whole career like that unless there's something about you that gets people to keep wanting to come back to see you,
sure,
you know?
Sure.
So it's not just that technique. So, you know, little things like, for example, I read somewhere that charismatic people, when they enter the room, I'm not saying anyone do this, but they tend to move slower than non-charismatic people. So there's a real pattern of all those kind of things. And it's not that I would encourage anyone to go out and study all the patterns, but just taking note of what is it about yourself that people find engaging?
Okay.
And can you be embody more of that.
So, okay, I'm so glad we're going here because this could get, I don't think controversial, but yeah. I'm hesitating a little bit bringing it up because I know it could be taken the wrong way. But, and you just said, you know, people shouldn't go out and kind of study those patterns. But maybe to throw out a bit of like a devil's advocate, little bit, is I remember being in grad school training for this and thinking to myself, wow, this person that's in the program probably doesn't need to be a therapist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that they didn't make it.
Right, right.
And part of it was, and I don't know what the formula for this would be, but they didn't have the personality. They didn't have the charisma for it. Okay, so I'm gonna bracket that for a second. Something I think you and I do connect over is there's, in the modern marketplace of psychotherapy, there's all this literature and all this push for more techniques. Mm-hmm. Here's the 5 steps to master, you know, CBT or whatever. I don't see enough reflection on what does it look like to embody a certain kind of presence, or could you work on cultivating charisma in a healthy way?
Right.
So I know I threw out a lot
Paul.
What do you think about what I've been saying there?
Perfect, 100%. Yeah, there are ways. The research is out there. I wish I could cite it off the top of my head, but I can't.
Oh, damn, I thought you could. Come on.
No. Yeah, it's one of those days. But there are patterns that certainly we can all learn from that. And watching people who we admire, who exude confidence and charisma, and how do they say things, how do they do things. At the same time, one does not want to do it so much that we just become a carbon copy of someone.
Right.
Because our clients see,
they're going to see through right through that. It won't be authentic.
Exactly. Yeah. You have to be your authentic self. And listen, Carl Rogers, if you watch him, old videos of him, he was just very quiet and peaceful.
Yeah.
But there is a charisma there compared to, you know, Ellis, more loud and aggressive. And so it's going to take a different form depending on who's exhibiting it. I want to go back to what you said about some people, in school, and they're maybe, you know, and sure enough, they didn't make it, or worse, maybe they did make it out seeing clients, and you wonder, it's like, oh, I don't know.
Or even if I could just stop real quick,
please.
And again, I'm not going to name any names, and I'm not trying to be harsh, but I even know some contemporary colleagues where they really struggle to maintain clients and to have an effective practice.
Right.
And I think some of it has to do with this. Mm-hmm. They may not be the best personality for psychotherapy. And I struggle saying that.
No, but I think you're 100% right. And that's where I was kind of going.
Okay.
Is that indeed, it's hard to measure
it is.
Personality.
It is.
You know, that's such a strange construct. But at the same time, what is it that makes a good therapist? My colleagues, Mark Hubble and Scott Miller, did an article years ago called Super Shrinks, how the best performers in the field, what do they do? And there are certain things they did that made them better at what they did, but they didn't go in as much into about charisma.
Okay.
They didn't go in enough about the personality because it's hard to determine. However, I will just go on the record and I'll take the slingshots and take it off my buddy Kike here.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think that some, you either got it or you don't.
Okay. I believe that 100%.
Yeah. There's some people who can, well, I'll give you an example. Some people pick up the guitar and they play pretty well, but there's only one Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
21 Eddie Van Halen, you know what I mean? You know, there's only one Les Paul. There's only, you know, so, but these doesn't mean that you can't play and
right,
be good,
right.
But something about the way they're made takes them to places that other people wouldn't go. And I don't mean that you can't make yourself better. Wherever you are, you can't make yourself better. But there's a personality thing that, you know, when you sit down with somebody, and you and I have both been clients as well as
Absolutely.
Therapists, that we knew real quick sitting down with somebody, it's like, okay, this guy or girl's got the mojo or they don't.
And I went to several, and it was very obvious from the beginning, if they had it or not. Absolutely.
Yeah, I asked a client the other day about, we're wrapping up, and she's like, well, I'm glad I finally found you. I went through five other therapists to find you. I'm like, number one, good for your tenacity to keep going, but it's like, you know, and I appreciate the kind word, but at the same time, I didn't say this, but I'm thinking, what the heck is going on that you had to go through five? But again, if it's a personality thing, maybe
sure.
there's not.
But I've had that conversation too where I was like, there's a pattern here.
Right, right, yeah. And a lot of folks who can't keep clients, it's maybe it's either them, their personality's the problem. Maybe it's that they're holding too close to a theoretical orientation and
yes.
they're too rigid.
Yes.
Or third, they're not allowing themselves to be themselves. And
okay.
I think that's a problem.
Maybe, okay, let's, and I think this all kind of connects to this book and some really.
You really thought we were going to follow the book. I could tell. It's like we're all over the map here.
No, but I love it. No, this is great. This is exactly who you are. And it's more of who I want to be. So I like kind of the freedom.
Yeah.
What, okay, so there, in the last statement that you made, I mean, one of the things that pops out for me is we have a need to stick so closely to a theoretical orientation. I wonder where your brain goes with that. I think there's probably a lot there.
Yeah, well, we're taught, and I think I'm generalizing, but I think for most of us, we're taught, particularly in grad school, that you got to choose a theoretical orientation. And part of being ethical is that you're grounded in a certain orientation. And
sure.
I can understand that because that, even though techniques only account for at most 13% of change, according to a lot of the research.
Okay.
That 13% is still very important.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. But when that's all you got, then that's kind of hard. You know,
yeah.
if the technique's all you got, you don't have the therapeutic alliance. You don't have the ability to drop technique A and pick up technique two. You don't have the ability or the thought that maybe I should abandon what we're doing. I am pretty convinced, I have no empirical evidence, but I'm convinced that most of the so-called resistant clients are just due to therapists being so rigid in the way they're working that when the client doesn't go along with what specific way the therapist wants, well, they're resistant. Whereas if they just maybe take in a different tack sometime and how to deal with this so-called resistance and be more creative, who knows, you know, something might open up. So that's how I view it, is that if we're getting so rigid in what we're doing in anything, it's like I may be the best guy with a hammer, but, you know, not everything's a nail.
Not everything's a nail.
But man, that hammer works really well. I mean, you even knock screws in
sometimes. Sure.
A lot of damage when you try to do it, you know. I can, you know. Can't really change my oil with a hammer, you know. So maybe the oil's being resistant. I don't know. It's just kind of funny the things that we tell ourselves about. You know, this person's resistant, that person's resistant, and sometimes, you know, let's be honest, that may be so.
Yeah.
But maybe they're being resistant to us, where they might not be resistant to someone else.
Right.
That's why getting good supervision is good, and having colleagues that, hey, would you mind sitting in with me on this one? And you know, I get a lot of calls from people. Sometimes they're just kind of like, can you, pull something out of your hat? Help me out here. And I'm like, you know, I don't know. I have to sit in the room sometimes and hear it. But that's what I mean. It's like if we come too rigid in anything.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know one area that if you're incredibly rigid as far as in your life, that's a beneficial thing. Because it may in the short term work, but, you know.
Yeah, and I think too, I think maybe in our field and in other areas, we hold so tightly to these things because we're afraid of the unknown.
Yeah.
We get uncomfortable with mystery.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, one of your chapters is entitled like the magic of the unknown. I was hoping we could get to that.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
But I do think it can be kind of scary to not know what the next step is.
Yeah.
As a therapist, I mean, obviously as a client, they're sitting there with a lot of uncertainty as well.
Mm-hmm, yeah. The client in particular, I think we forget how uncomfortable they are.
Yes.
You know? So, but yet how brave they are and how open they are. And I think if we allow ourselves a degree of freedom and flexibility and to be more authentic,
yes,
we're actually indirectly giving them the signal that they can start exhibiting those traits. You know, there's a whole part of behavior therapy on modeling, where the therapist will model things for the client. Well,
sure.
I can't think of a better thing to model is to be who you are, to be unique. I mean, you know, listen, as much as I want to be Elvis, there's only one Elvis brother, you know? And he's left the building.
Yeah.
And there's Elvis impersonators who do Elvis better than Elvis, you know? And that wonderful actor in the recent Elvis movie, I can't remember his name.
Austin Butler.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Amazing. But... you know, he's not Elvis. Yeah,
right.
Elvis walks in, talking about charisma, oh my God, yes. He walks in the room, you know, everyone's looking at Elvis, and no matter what I do, if I can talk like Elvis and do my little bit, you know, baby, you know,
wait, can maybe, you sing a song for us?
No, yeah,
I'm just kidding.
Very badly, yeah. But I'll never be Elvis. But then again, Elvis could never be Paul J. Leslie or Kiki Autry, you know, so it's, I think we, and to me that's a... we often minimize ourselves.
Okay.
And we do it in our sessions. We do it in our lives and say, oh, well, I should be this. Because we're doing these comparisons to other therapists, comparisons to other people. And yeah, I'll never be Elvis. But, you know, Elvis couldn't sit in a room with, you know, somebody who's had a lifetime of trauma. And, you know, I mean, he might be able to buy him a house and a car, but I'm the one who they're sitting with, who they open up to. So.
I don't think I really took off as a therapist and really started to build something and have some real effective moments with clients until I was able to finally just kind of be myself.
Yeah.
You know, in the very beginning, I was, and I think it was anxiety, it was that uncertainty. I was a little, quite a bit more rigid when it came to like the theoretical orientation, and it had to be certain interventions, and if there was any resistance, it was, you know, the client. When I finally went through a process of just embracing who I was as a person and bringing that into the therapy, that's mm-hmm. when the magic really started to happen. Yeah. I think.
Well, I think that's with anything.
Yeah.
You know, musicians.
Yeah, and my relationships too, right?
Family,
in my second marriage, it's really come out in a beautiful way.
Oh, yeah.
I get to be myself.
Yeah. My wife may argue about me being myself. It's really that fantastic. But,
you know, you're going to have to like hide a little bit more, Paul.
Yeah,
come on.
I'll tell you. I know. Musicians, actors, all these people, they have to put on a performance.
Yeah.
A lot of times. You know, Elvis was Elvis on stage, but, you know, he was probably a much different person behind the scenes, and the same of, you know, an actor puts on this performance, and then, you know, they're, oh, I met this actor or actress, and she was nothing like, well, you're only seeing, you know, that part of them. And for me, if you're going to be a therapist, if you can be as congruent as possible and authentic as possible, the person that you are that you run into at the grocery store is not that much different than the person you are in the therapy room.
Yeah.
And some folks feel that, you know, they have to, you know, and I'm not saying lose your boundaries, good, you know, I think it's good boundaries, all
sure.
that is important, ethical and all. But this may go back to the whole thing. If that's not authentically you and you don't have the mojo, it really doesn't matter what technique I give you. And if one doesn't feel like they can be who they are, I do a big thing. Who I am is I love to tease people in a playful way and say things that,
you know,
kind of zing them in a fun way.
But, and in getting to know you this weekend, that's totally you.
Yeah, I couldn't be any other way. And most of the time, my clients are okay with it. But then that's part of the discernment process. When is it okay to start doing that? Who can take it? Who doesn't?
Right.
You know, but humor is a wonderful trait that we can all bring into therapy.
Absolutely.
If it's authentic with who we are.
Yes.
Some people
yes.
just aren't funny.
I mean, no.
It's just the way it is, you know?
No, absolutely.
Yeah. And if they're not, they have other things that they can be authentic. Some people might not be funny and quick-witted, but they can be grounded and peaceful and exude kindness and love, and their clients change just sitting with them, you know? I'm a big believer that sometimes if you're in the presence of someone who's really exudes a kindness and a love, that alone can be transformative.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, they don't even have to tell you information, you know?
Yeah.
I wish I could be that person, you know?
See, but I think you are. I experience you that way.
Really?
And I hope this doesn't sound like I'm tooting my own horn, but that's something that a lot of people have said about me as well.
Oh, I could see that.
That just kind of being in my presence.
Yeah. We have the Mutual Appreciation Society here where we're,
you're great, folks. My mom will tell me that when I was just a young boy, could barely talk, I would just sit in the middle of the adults that were talking. I would just listen. And then people would want to draw close and just talk to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I didn't choose to do that.
Right.
You know, sure, I've worked on cultivating some of that gift, but it's just kind of who I am in some ways.
Well, that's the part that I think can't be taught.
Okay.
That who you are is what you came into this world. You know, we spend a whole lifetime, so many of us, trying to be something that society and culture thinks we should be. Because maybe we have to be, because I got to make a living, or I got to do this, or I got to do that in order to, you know, keep my life to some degree of sanity. But down deep, I think some of us are born artists, some of us are born engineers, some of us are born veterinarians, some of us are born teachers. And if we could, not just vocationally, but those aspects that we're born with and cultivate them, I think that's where life is.
Yes.
I think trying to be something that we're not because we think we should be, that we do ourselves a great disservice. Same thing as therapists. If I think I should be a therapist who's a trauma therapist,
right,
who's up on all the latest mindfulness, and I need to be a mindful, but that doesn't fit who I am.
No.
You know, I've tried that. I mean, mindfulness is great, but I'm about interaction.
Yes. Okay. So I want to go there.
Yeah.
That's exactly where I want to go, because even though I realize, I think I've said this before, I've been kind of embodying so many of the things that you write. I just didn't have the language for it because so much of my work is with autistic clients. And if anyone really spends a lot of time with autistic clients, you know, you can't really be non-directive and just say, tell me how that feels, and kind of the stereotypical therapist way of relating, where you're just not saying much. You kind of have to just roll your sleeves up and just jump into it and be very creative and interactive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering how you kind of came to that realization. Was it always in you? Were you always kind of an interactive therapist, or did you kind of come to that at some point in your career?
I think there's always been some part of me that loved to interact as far as do a back and forth with people.
Okay, okay.
As I mentioned, I love to have playful banter with people. So I can see the seeds of that there. For me, theoretically, I just was naturally drawn to interaction-oriented type of therapies, like strategic therapy.
Okay. Is that Jay Haley?
Jay Haley, all the Mental Research Institute, they sometimes call it brief problem-solving therapy.
Okay.
Haley's strategic therapy, and then he and his former wife, Chloe Madonis, did a strategic family therapy.
Okay.
And certainly Milton Erickson, a solution oriented therapy, Bill O'Hanlon, solution focus, DeShazer and Berg, and I could keep going. I actually have a list here so I don't miss it. I was just talking about this brief strategic therapy, resource focused therapy, Ericksonian therapy. You know, everything comes from Uncle Milton Erickson, my spiritual uncle. I'm saying that is a source of humor, but his influence, Erickson's influence over that whole field of getting people to do things differently, to create more flexibility in their lives, and that the idea that how we as therapists, what we are doing and being in a session is as important as anything that the client is doing. And that is the back and forth dynamic co-creative experience. So for me, I think I've just always naturally been drawn to that. I've tried to be indirect, and sometimes I'm very indirect, but sometimes I just feel maybe my personality, hey, look, let's do something. Let me direct you in an ethical way to create change.
Sure. And this is not necessary. I mean, I think some people could hear what we're saying and think, okay, so you're telling people what to do, or you're just giving them the answers, or you're trying to fix their problems. I don't think we're saying that at all.
No.
How would you maybe parse out those two strategies? Obviously, what I just said is quite a bit of a caricature.
But
I think there's some people listening maybe who are more in the psychodynamic tradition who would hear what we're saying and thinking, oh my gosh, you know, that's why those psychotherapists are crazy.
Right, yeah. Well, I get that. You know, it's like the old joke about psychodynamic guys was in a psychoanalysis for 10 years, and they asked him, well, how's it going? He says, well, I understand a whole lot more, but I don't feel any better, you know?
Yeah.
So, I would be rather hesitant if I was from an orientation where it was about insight.
Yeah.
And one thing Dr. Erickson wrote or said or something is that insight does very little to create change. It's really experience that leads to insight. So you can't have a lot of times insight alone. There has to be a change. I think that's why you saw a change from rationally motive therapy to now a cognitive behavioral therapy, because the behavior has to be the action. It has to be action oriented. It's one thing to know where something comes from, but if I can help a client experience their problem in a different way, that will go further toward transforming them and their ability to change the problem than knowing where it came from. You know, maybe my anxiety or my depression or, you know, fill in the blank came from my childhood, or maybe it came from not feeling good enough in school, or, you know, you can fill in the blanks or whatever. But that doesn't do anything to really create massive adjustments in how I see myself in this crazy world.
Okay.
But if I can have an experience of me doing something differently, it lets my brain know, hey, we don't have to stick in this pattern that we've had maybe for far too long. So I'm naturally wanting to do action. Also, it's also easier to kind of manage outcomes, because if I can see, did we do this? What happened? It's a little easier to spot where we are in the process. If therapy's too gray and I don't know where we are, but eventually we'll get there, you know.
Sure.
That just doesn't quite work for me, my personality.
Okay.
My goal, we have a terrible business model. I might have even said this our last thing, is that our goal is to hurry and get people better so we never see them again.
Right.
And my dry cleaner doesn't do that. He doesn't, you know, we got this done as soon as possible. Never come back unless you absolutely have to.
Right.
You know? So as a business, and that's a whole different conversation about business, you know, our goal is to create something. I think ethically we have to do something to help people rather than just allow. I mean, we can you know, talk about projections and all these things all day long. And honestly, I think a lot of that's true stuff. And if you can spot your projection onto people, and then, but guess what? Even if you spot it, in order to change, you've got to do something different.
Yes.
So I just kind of skip the middleman and go right to the action.
Okay.
And I find that just works better for me, just Paul J. Leslie, no one else. You know?
Got you. Now, can you, for yourself and maybe more broadly, can you speak to the role of intuition? And, you know, in the book, you talk about just like the therapist following their gut during certain moments. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm thinking of things that I've accessed from you where I think at this point in your career, you'll have just a spontaneous thought or sensation that kind of comes up and you just kind of go with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, tell us about that, but then also tell us, are you sometimes wrong, or does it not land with the client? And then kind of what do you do at that point?
Yes.
That's a lot there.
Yes, yeah, it is. It is, but it's all good. I think it just takes time and wisdom.
Okay.
And not that I'm wise, but
no, that's a good word, wisdom. That's yeah, that's an important concept.
Clinical wisdom. Yes. Not so much that I'm a wise individual sure, in every area sure, of life, but clinical wisdom in that, okay, is this about me or is this about them?
Okay.
You know, it's yeah, like it's like self-disclosure in therapy.
Yes, yes.
We're taught. Some people are like, never self-disclose. Other people's like, yeah, you're feeling it. You know how you tell, you know, sometimes it helps people. But what do we learn? You have to know when to do it, where to do it, and with whom. You
and,
know?
And that's wisdom, right? Yeah. To be able to discern.
Mm-hmm. So for me, if I feel something strongly enough, that wisdom of having made mistakes, of learning things and seeing where things work well, that's what guides me. That intuition, to allow the intuition. Okay, oh, I'm feeling this, let's say it. Sometimes I have to catch myself and go, like, really, is this,
yeah,
or is this just me trying to come up with something? If I feel like I'm trying to come up with something, I abandon it immediately.
Okay.
Because if I'm thinking okay, too hard about it, it's not natural and it's not spontaneous, and I need something spontaneous. Second part of your question, have I done it and it hasn't gone anywhere? Yes. So what do you do? It's kind of the part 2A of your question. You just keep going.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't work, you go. It's like playing volleyball. You know, the ball goes over the net and it comes right back, goes over the net. You're just playing volleyball. If what I do, it just dies, the ball hits the ground, I just grab a ball and do a different thing.
Sure.
So if I ask somebody something, I think we're heading a certain direction. I ask somebody something that I swear is going to be, and it just doesn't go anywhere. I just will drop it. Oh, okay. Yeah, no worries. And then just hop back into the flow of our dynamic exchange.
Yeah.
Happens all the time.
That really resonates with me. I mean, one of the things I do at this point is when I'm starting out with a client in kind of that intake session, I'll talk about, you know, at some level, you're paying me and you're seeing me as the expert, but I may have some expertise around the process of therapy, but you're the expert of your own life. And part of what that's going to mean is I'm going to maybe say things that don't always land. I might, you know, move us in a direction that doesn't feel quite right. I want to be able to collaborate with you to know mm-hmm. when that's happening. So mm-hmm. if I've gotten something wrong, or if I've said something that's kind of off, I want to be open about the fact that I'm not perfect and we can kind of move in a different direction.
Right. Yeah. It's basically seeking feedback.
Exactly. Okay. And yeah. Feedback, speak to that.
That's feedback is incredibly important. As a matter of fact, there's a whole subset of the field called feedback informed treatment that a lot of that comes out of the common factors work. But that is simply charting where are you in getting the feedback from your client verbally. Sometimes you have them at the end of the session write,
yeah,
you know, score, how did we do. People who do that tend to do better than, I mean, this is empirically shown, tend
sure.
to do better than those who don't ask. Even just ask, you know, even if they don't write something down, just say, okay, what was this session like for you? And every first session, at the end, even if I think it went well, I'll say, okay, before you leave today, I wonder if you could just be honest with me and tell me, what's this session been like in here with me today? And sometimes they'll say, well, I was a little nervous when I came in, but, you know, kind of warmed up. Well, I didn't like where you started out, but I think we got some, you know, and this is all good feedback.
Yeah.
Sometimes every now and then someone will say, well, I really didn't feel like, you know, I was able to tell my story. Well,
right.
That immediately
right.
tells me I really screwed up. So I got to say, hey, I am so sorry. You know what? What we're going to do, since we're at the end, when you come back, I guarantee you your story is going to be heard. And I want to hear every bit. And if I've overtaught, maybe I've been overzealous and I just wanted to help and I didn't pay attention. And for that, I am deeply sorry.
Yeah.
Because that, I want to be that level of humility, because if I've screwed up, it's on me. It's not on them. They're
sure.
being them. I'm being me. And sometimes I'm the therapist here.
Absolutely.
So I got to make sure doing right. There's different measures that your your client can fill out and sign scaling stuff that's out in the public domain, you can get, and those can be even more helpful where they feel more comfortable writing down and scoring you. And
sure,
you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, they give you a 3 and you go, okay, can we talk about how did the 3, how did you get there? And they some will tell you, and then you go, okay, what do I need to do? It hurts our ego.
Yeah.
And it's also sometimes helps our ego, because when we see we're doing really well, we
that's get, a good point.
Get good. But if we're terrified to get any feedback, then we'll never improve. So right. You know, just find that.
I think that's crucial. So I'm thinking of the book and some of the things we've been talking about, going back to the importance of being interactive. Do you think this is where bringing in therapeutic rituals comes in? Like I wonder if you could kind of speak to that. Like how have you connected ritual to your desire to be an effective interactive therapist? How do those two kind of come together for you?
Well, for me, if I go back and I look, interrupting dysfunctional patterns is number one.
Okay.
And for some people, some of those patterns are so entrenched at the somatic level, at the emotional level, that any information that I give them,
they're like a fish in water.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, who doesn't know at this point? Oh, I know, I'm thinking negative.
Yeah,
or all the, you know, it's,
you think that's negative? Yeah, let me tell you.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. So, for me, if to get at that deep level for some people, not everyone, but for some people, symbolic representations, I said you should say, of their problem, and then having them do something that almost is a way to solve the problem, their own problem, or as a way to where they feel they have more power over their problem. Sometimes it's to play the story out.
Okay.
You know, what's trauma about? Trauma about really is things happen to us and we get stuck. That's all it is. Our brain gets stuck. Most people, if they've gone through a traumatic event, like just one, we're not talking about like repeated, but just one, you ask them, where, when you have the memory, where does it end? 8 out of 10 times it ends before the memory's over. I mean, before the event's over. It's always at the worst part where they thought they were going to die or, you know, whatever's happening. And that's why they found sometimes by just getting them to talk through it and then add the ending several times. And, oh, but then I, you know, my family came and they put their arms around me and I was okay, or the police arrived, or just giving him that. So we all need to have a happy ending.
Yeah.
And so sometimes a therapeutic ritual is to play something symbolic out that represents the problem, but then have a new ending, or to feel like I have control over this. I mean, you know, I had I can't remember whatever. I've written so many blasted books. I don't know if it's in this one or not, but it's.
Let's see if I remember.
Yeah. A lady who had some issues with family, and she had to put pictures of her family on this big watermelon and then carry the watermelon on a hike up the hills.
That's amazing.
And it got heavy, you know, carrying that watermelon. And then she had to pick a place where she was willing to let that go. And so to let her anger out and everything at her family. So she had to take a hammer in her backpack. And then when she got to a place where she finally felt she couldn't carry it anymore, she set it down. And then she was to destroy it with a hammer because her family picture's all there. It sounds very violent and all that, but it's a symbolic thing of I now tell you I'm not taking you any further with me, and I'm cutting and destroying this tie, you know, at that unconscious level. Now, we can say that's the unconscious, but we can also say somebody got her to take a hike with something and do something so out of the ordinary that it gave her flexibility in how she felt.
Yes.
So either way, it's interrupting that kind of pattern, changing the storyline.
Yeah. You know? And don't you see this with, you know, people like Alejandro Jodorowsky and just other kind of shamanic traditions?
Absolutely.
You see this disruption of these patterns with kind of out of the way, sometimes even bizarre rituals that are helping them to reenact it in a symbolic way and then hopefully find some kind of healing.
Yeah. I think if we think of rituals, therapeutic rituals, I think therapy as a whole is a therapeutic ritual. I mean, if you were, you know, I've been picking on the psychodynamic crowd a few minutes ago, but so now I'm going to praise the psychodynamic crowd. The traditional psychoanalysis, I mean, how much more ritualistic can you get? Right. You got to show up at a certain time. You got to lie on a certain couch. You got to do a free association. You got to talk about your dreams, for God's sake. Totally. I mean, that's some pretty heavy. So you don't even get into the Jungian offshoot of that.
Oh yeah.
So to me, that's all pretty pretty ritualistic kind of stuff. And that going back, tying back into my book, see how I did that? I tied it back into my book.
So glad you did. Slam dunk on
that
one. Said,
yeah. A lot of experience. I'm a professional.
Okay.
So, but that's where the magic is. Is your therapy a improvisational ritual?
Yes.
And that to me is, if you had to put it in a nutshell, that is a spontaneous improvisational ritual. Now, ritual is something you do the same, you can do the same way multiple times. But most of the rituals, if you do them every day the same way, they kind of lose their power.
Mm-hmm.
So this moment in time, can you make this, you know, moment with your client a ritual way? Even just talking about the mundane of life.
Absolutely. Know? Oh, so good. So, okay, here's a question. Just because we've been kind of hovering over the psychodynamic piece just for a little bit.
Yeah.
I have a sense that you're not probably going to have a rigid theory about dreams.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if you ever utilize your clients' dreams in a kind of interactive way. Because that is a piece. I was kind of trained in kind of the Jungian tradition. I'm not a Jungian, but I appreciate aspects of that work. And dreams, not for all my clients. Some don't even want to bring them up. But for some, they find it so helpful to kind of creatively work with them.
You know, years ago when I was teaching at the college, Intro to Psych, General Psychology 101.
Yeah.
We get to the part about Freud and psychoanalysis. And then, you know, you talk really about three or four techniques because it's an intro.
Sure.
You know, free association, transference, you know, those kind of. And then dream analysis. And so we would do something where everyone would talk about, do you have a dream, a recurring, because I didn't want to hear about just a one-off.
Yeah,
I want to hear about a recurring dream. And when people would tell me that, and all I would do is saying, okay, now don't tell me what's happened in your life, because you know this is not the place for it. But I want you to go back and I want you to think about the first time you had that dream. And what was really going on there? And they'll sit and they'll think. And I said, now you've been having that dream lately. How is what's going on now similar? In some way, strange way. And it's like you see them light up and they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't. And it's like, talk about insight.
Sure.
Maybe nothing changes, but it's that, oh wow, that power of our unconscious mind to create this symbolic imagery to deal with things that maybe we haven't dealt with, or to just kind of help us to go through different stages. You ask me how often I do it with my clients. Not that often, but I have. And it can be very fascinating. You can get a lot of information.
Yeah.
And for some reason, dreams have always been, I mean, God, go back thousands of years, have been so important, you know.
Well, that's exactly right. Are you familiar with the American, he just recently passed last year, the American author Cormac McCarthy?
I am not.
Okay. So he mainly wrote fiction throughout his life, Pulitzer Prize winning author, really a tremendous person. But he has one, I think it's one nonfiction piece that he wrote, and it was on his theory of dreams. And just to kind of summarize it quickly, I always go back to this. He was really big into evolutionary science and all that. And he said, if you just go back to our evolutionary history, we were very likely dreaming and then painting on caves before we used complex verbal speech and language.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, he wasn't creating a huge, you know, theory around this, but he just said, there's a sense in which the deepest parts of us are connected to the symbolic. And sometimes we have to stay close to that and not always rely on the verbal and that part of our brain. So I just always think that's a bit of a clue. When someone brings up a dream, it might be helpful to kind of think about and work with that.
Yeah,
it might connect to a deep part of them.
Right, exactly. And if it is definitely a recurring dream, there's something that's wanting to be heard.
I like that. I like that. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so Paul, I know I'm kind of coming to the end of the questions that I had.
Yeah, man.
I know one thing I did want to ask you is there a current project that you're working on that you could speak to, or even a type of aspiration for something?
Honestly, I got to be direct with you. No. I'm usually...
Well, we got to change that.
Yeah, exactly, man. The last decade of my life has been nothing but projects and aspirations. And I guess I'm hitting my midlife crisis because it's like it... I think I have a sense that something is in the future, but I don't know what it is.
And okay.
My personal therapy right now is to not get hung up about it because I always like to have an answer.
Okay.
And some things are unanswerable.
Okay.
You can't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to be at peace with something's going to happen for me in the future, and I don't know. But I will tell you, I have scaled back a little bit on teaching, workshops and things like that. And just kind of saying, okay, where am I now? How can I make the best use of my time? I've been gifted, I'm in my 50s now, so I've been gifted half a century.
Mm.
It's had its ups and downs, but, you know, I'm alive and... decent health at this point, so there's something, and I feel it's like my responsibility to create, but I don't know what right now. I mean professionally, yeah, I've got, you know, I got a couple workshops I'm doing, you know, this year, but as far as the big thing like the art of creating a magical session, I don't know. I every time I finish a book, I tell people, I'm done. I'm not going to write another one.
Okay.
That was like 5 books ago.
Yeah, so. I don't believe that. So, okay, so maybe another kind of question, and maybe I'm just kind of, you know, trying to find something that's not there, but is there either an author or an idea or just something that's got you curious? Whether it's psychotherapy, related to psychotherapy or not, I'm just always curious
about
the people that I respect and I look up to, if they're what they're reading, what they're thinking about.
Outside of the realm of my field, I'm interested a lot in the work as far as the writings of a guy named Dr. Bernardo Kastrup. That's K-A-S-T-R-U-P.
Oh, yeah. He's great.
Yeah, I had the privilege of talking to him online one time and kind of asked him some questions. And his whole idea of our consciousness not being a secondary aspect of our brain, that our consciousness is primary.
Yeah.
And empirically... I mean, he's got a PhD in...
like computer science. Yeah.
And he's gotten another PhD in philosophy.
Yeah, that's wild.
So, but his ideas are very compelling. Again, I'm not sure it's 100%, but
sure.
He really does, when he lays it out in logical, it's hard to kind of dispute all of his points. Some of his points, it's kind of like, geez, he may be right about that, because he's questioning the very assumptions of a materialistic universe.
Right.
And so, you know, that's kind of sacred cow that, you know, may make some good hamburger eventually,
yeah,
but, you know, right now I'm fascinated his work. I have a friend in Sweden. He's Irish. His name's James Tunney. He's a barrister, and he's retired, I think, now from he was expert on international law, but he's turned his attention to the rise of technology and AI and those things, and how detrimental that can be to humanity. And, you know, he views humans as in a spiritual growth, and how that may actually retard their growth.
Sure.
And so those are the kind of, you know, heavy topics. Other than that, there's always gardening.
Okay.
You know, and going to high teas like we had.
Absolutely.
So trying to, you know, not take life so darn
hosting
seriously.
Hosting complete strangers.
Yeah, complete
from
strangers
different states.
From different parts of the country, which, you know,
we're very grateful
for. Oh, no, we just had a blast. And I think you're doing some really fantastic work.
Thank you,
and
Paul.
I know what you're doing, and I want to say this for the record, what you're doing specifically, the populations you're working with, I think it's so important, because I feel that we have so long tried to put people into boxes as clients. And
yes.
I think with the work you and your wife are doing with your new business and clinic, and as that opens up, I think you may be busier than you expect.
Mm.
And when you're helping people in a field, a niche, if you will, that has been kind of overlooked in some ways.
Yes.
I think
it's both. It's been overlooked, or it's actually been rigidly put in a box in terms of how you should do therapy with this population. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason why I'm so excited about starting it, and just why your work is so energizing and magical for me is if I feel like it gives me permission to be very creative and interactive and out of the box in the work that I do with so many of these people.
Right. Yeah. Well, I just think you're going to find a lot of interesting doors open in the future.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. Well, Paul, thank you again for hosting us. Thank you for this conversation. Yeah, man. I hope that it's not the last one.
Oh, it definitely won't be.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
Sure.